And welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Bill Still. We're talking about Greece, the European Union, the bigger financial situation, the economy, and so much more, of course. I wanted to ask you more about loans and how to go about this, let's say, in a situation as an individual in Greece, let's say. I mean, if we go back a little bit historically, Bill, we can understand, obviously, that loans have been both beneficial and detrimental to the Western world. Because of the dependency, of course, that's a major negative factor. But then at the same time, you have this other aspect to it that you can, in the past, been able to go in to a bank or something else. If you're one of the lucky ones, you can get a loan, invest in a new production of whatever you're doing, a new company. With that money, of course, you can purchase your material to be able to produce the products and then begin to sell it to make profit, and then hopefully at the end of the day, pay off the loan with the interest. And then you've managed to get some, profit that you either can turn into, more products, et cetera, to get things going and get the wheels turning. So that's been one way of doing it. But let's say if that's no longer good because of the dependency that the loans come with, or even the prospect that you have to give the ideas to the bank, as you're begging them to get money, what would you argue in this scenario? I mean, today, internet companies are some of the most successful, I think. I think a lot of people, they're utilizing the technology that is available, which basically is you'd put a little bit of money into beginning a production, very, very little, to have a few items, basically. And with that, you can actually begin to sell some. If you do sell it with the money that you can get back, you turn it into the company again, and you try to produce more items. Basically, try to get it going the slow way. But at the same time, that would be more, you're building it from the ground up in a completely different way. You're not dependent on the banks. You don't have the same pressure on you. You don't have the possibility that they get into your business and telling you how to do it or what to do. But what, I mean, there has been a beneficial aspect to the lending in the past, in one sense then. But what would you recommend for people who are in Greece, let's say, in this situation? Is it to get it going the slow way and just starting up very, very small, or how to get something going if you don't have the money to put it in to begin with? What do you think?
Well, under a monetary reform situation, which is what we're going to try to push, Greece is going to need a lot of stuff, and there'll be no shortage of smart entrepreneurs worldwide who are going to see that and who are going to be combing Greece for people with residual expertise in, let's say, producing television sets. And yeah, maybe there's a 80-year-old guy who used to run a television set manufacturing firm. Well, they're going to snatch him up and put him at the head of this company and start making the TV sets in Greece, because Greece isn't going to have the money to import them off of ships. And then after a little while, after a couple of years, when that business is up and running successfully, the German version of Walmart or whatever is going to say, these German and Chinese TVs, their price is pretty high now. And these Greek TVs, they just built a brand new modern plant, and they're making better TVs for cheaper money. Why don't we just send a truck down there and buy them off of Greece instead of buying them off a ship from China? And pretty soon Greece is going to have a balance of payment surplus. And then they're really going to be up and running. And when you multiply this times all of the manufacturing that a country needs to produce its consumables on a regular basis, they can come back very strong, very quickly. And if they do so outside of the EU context, their freedom will be, as much as you can, permanently insured.
So it's with this crash, and you mentioned this 200-year cycle earlier. It's with this in mind that you've been able to kind of maybe reboot production. I mean, it's an ironic way about it, but yet at the same time, we can understand that that's how things are being run in nature, for example, in the natural world. You don't have continuous growth all the time on something. You have to have a fallback period, and with that, space, if you will, that's left, but because of that fallback, you can begin to create something new. And that's in that way, you're seeing maybe potential, tremendous potential in Greeks to become a new producing country, basically.
Well, and isn't that the way life itself is? I mean, just look at your inhalations and exhalations. That's how we breathe. And you know, there's I just saw something very interesting. I rarely watch television, but my wife was watching this this show on Bloomberg interview show last night with Charlie Rose, and he was interviewing all these young internet entrepreneurs who, you know, the folks who had created all the big companies we've heard about, PayPal, Google, etc. And basically, they were saying that their crystal ball looking into the future is that, you know, right now, the way content that we consume, most of the content we consume, well, it's changing rapidly now, but the way it was, let's say, 5 years ago, had to go through major production studios in New York or Hollywood to, you know, be funneled into the television sets for us all to consume. But how much television do you consume right now? I know I consume almost zero. All of the content I consume, I'll bet you 97% of the content I consume right now comes off of my computer screen. And 5 years from now, it's going to be an even more radical change, to where all of the almost all of the content that all of us consume will no longer be produced in New York and Hollywood in the major studios. It'll all be decentralized and all come over the internet. So this is very hopeful. In other words, your power right now as an independent radio producer, and my power as, you know, some guy in the backwoods crying for help about saving the world, our power is going to do nothing. But we are right on the cutting edge. We are in the right place at the right time. And we have to understand that this wave is coming, and it's only going to benefit us. And to me, this is a good sign for freedom.
Well, it's encouraging in that way, because again, it's decentralizing that power. It's the it's the opposite way of what's going on with the EU, for example, and all the world government proponents. And I think that this is the way that things need to be run. I mean, you have, again, if you go back to the internet, you know, entrepreneurs and all that, and some of the most successful companies, I think, right now are basically just online based, and there's technology as well that enables that. You have, you know, on-demand printing, but there's even smaller things you can do. Again, I go back to that idea that you can do just very, very small runs. You don't have to be a huge mega monopoly company to be able to pick up a production of, you know, basically anything today to be able to pull it off. You can do it fairly well if you know what you're doing and, you know, utilizing the different talents that are out there. And I think that this is the way things are going to go in the future. You're going to get a dispersal. And hopefully, Bill, we can see kind of a degradation of the monopoly companies, if you will, those who just have controlled and regulated all the different industries out there, and instead putting it out to a number of different people or a number of different companies, as opposed to just having, you know, one or two in any given field.
Well, and actually, if you look at the real core of what our problem is right now, it's not just consolidation at the nation-state level. It's transnational consolidation. And of course, the crown jewel for them are things like the European Union, the World Trade Organization, etc. And you know, what if this world consolidation of power government is also on a breathing in and breathing out cycle? What if right now they've already peaked and they're desperately trying to hold on to power, and that's really what's going on the mega cycle? But they're actually doomed to failure. They're doomed to being split up into a trillion different pieces as this internet presence, you know, comes to its full potential. And this is very, very hopeful to me.
Yeah, indeed. It's interesting. We have seen these cycles in the past. They do come and go, and I think that, of course, as their power is beginning to kind of wane a bit, I think that they're fearful of this and kind of try to take measures in order to, you know, preserve the power that they do have at this stage. But I think you're right, Bill. I think it is slowly going to diminish. It's going to be instead be, you know, distributed across the board. It's going to be something different. The question, though, is of course if politically and economically, there can be other solutions that kind of come to the surface, you know, at the same time. There are other things, I don't know about, you know, Bitcoin and everything else. There's some other things, interesting things floating around out there, but maybe we need more of these, more different solutions and smaller kind of denominations, if you will. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's, I hear all the time people say, oh, why are you fighting this? They've already won. You know, we're already enslaved. And I just think that doesn't do anybody any good to exaggerate the enemy's strength is the worst possible thing that we can do. I think we always have to err on the side of hopefulness, because if people don't have hope, they won't fight. They won't oppose these forces of evil. And I don't have to exaggerate when I say that I'm very hopeful. I've been doing this for 30 years, and it's only been in the last couple of years, that especially the last year, where now this is becoming international. People are understanding this consolidation, that this consolidation of power is going on, and they're opposing it and opposing it effectively. And I just see a tipping point coming to where a tipping point. It's kind of like the word hegemony in English. Hegemony doesn't mean a majority of power. Hegemony, H-E-G-E-M-O-N-Y, means that there's just a sufficient amount of power, and people see the direction of the rate, the direction of increase in that power, to see that it's going to eventually win. It's going to eventually gain a majority. That's what hegemony is. And I no longer think that the bad guys have the hegemony here. I think we're about to reach that tipping point where we gain the hegemony. And then you're going to see, just like all rats, when you shine a flashlight on them, they're going to go running, and they're all going to say, oh, we knew this all along. What are you talking about? This was our solution from the beginning.
Yeah, exactly. They're going to try to co-opt it, but I think you're right, though. I think it's part of the charade of the controlling, forces in the world that we do have, that they want to exude like they have more power than they actually have. I think because, I mean, as any battle goes, that's enemies and etc. They know that if you can defeat your enemy before they've even begun to try to do something about it, then you've won. So of course they're going to try to play that card. And I think that people might feel isolated, or they might feel that they're alone or whatever, but I think you're right, Bill. I think there's a lot of people in the world who are just starting to wake up to these ideas and realize that there is definitely more at play than what we get through the media. And just as you say, if people actually do turn off the TV and start monitoring some other sources out there, there's a lot of people who are pretty clever to the game and what's going on. So I think we shouldn't be discouraged with the fact that they want to try to pose as that they have everything under control, because they certainly do not.
No, they don't. And well, for example, I gave a keynote address in Malaysia last November at the Third World Conference on RIBA, and RIBA means interest or usury, and that's a whole nother topic maybe we can go into. But it was the biggest monetary reform conference I'd ever been to. There were 600 people in the room, and half of them were students, and it was mind blowing to me. Here I was on the exact opposite side of the earth from where I live, and these students were coming up to me, shaking, grabbing my hand in both of their hands, and kind of bowing, going, "Oh, money masters, money masters." And I couldn't believe that, I was on the opposite end of the world, and these kids had been influenced by the money masters positively. And these people are going to be the leaders in Malaysia a generation from now.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So where do you see that this is going then? Bill, tell us a little bit about some of the reforms that you would like to see in the world. And into this, of course, you can tie, usury, interest, and everything else. Where do we go for a system that is viable, that is, functioning, and kind of maybe at the same time, this is a tricky part and difficult part, but just as we described with the natural cycles, if you will, of this breathing in and out process, that you do have an up and a downfall. You have a summer, you have a winter. This is a part of the natural system. And so therefore, that's what an economy also should have, correct?
Well, right. And just to go on with my thought, I think that this tipping point is rapidly approaching. In fact, it may have already happened. We won't even know it for another 5 or 10 years. But this right now, this radio show, as a matter of fact, may be the world history tipping point. And we need to understand what the basis of human freedom is. And that is the ability of everyone to feel that their vote in self-governance counts. And whenever you get to a point where people start complaining about their legislatures, complaining about the government, everybody's going to complain about the government, but where let's say a majority of the people feel that the government has lost touch with the people, that they no longer have the ability to influence government, then you've got to fix it. You've got to change it, because government is all we've got. The anarchical solution is no solution at all. Because if you think that we can all just walk away from the power structure and somehow that's going to fix it, that's not the way it works. The bad guys will swoop in and seize any amount of crust of bread of power left on the floor that they can get their hands on. And
So what is the extent of government, do you think, then, Bill? What should be, what's viable, and also what is good for a structure to be able to preserve itself from actually, you know, getting infiltrated in this way? I mean, that's the biggest question of all, and it seems to be almost impossible, because in whatever scenario you look at in nature as well, where you have parasites, you have bacteria, you have viruses, and you have an immune system there to try to keep it out. But this battle is constantly kind of going, if you know what I'm getting at.
Well, yeah, you have to understand that the rules change all the time, and that as Benjamin Franklin said when he exited the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, and a lady asked him, "What have you given us, Mr. Franklin?" And he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." This is an ongoing process. That's why I just stress that you have to convince your children and grandchildren that they've got to get in there. They've got to run for office. They've got to be involved with self-governance, because self-governance is all we've got. Now, as far as the size of government and all that, that's going to depend from nation state to nation state on individual conditions. But of course, here in the United States, I love the model that we've got right now. I think we just need to return to it, where our government is decentralized and minimized to the greatest extent possible. We don't need to have these giant bloated governments, especially a federal government, where the individual states can be little mini experimental laboratories for everything that goes on, and where it works in one state, another variety might not work in another state. So, you know, it works very well that way. And nations can serve the whole, can serve the world in the same way. But what we absolutely need to oppose is the breaking down of the concept of the nation state, because once national borders are basically transgressed by significant international legislation, you're going to get nothing but trouble. We need to enter into transnational agreements with the greatest amount of caution and skepticism. And if we use that as the basic standard, and minimalization and of government, and a maximization of democratic input into the minimal government, I think we can't go wrong.
Representative politicians, maybe, as opposed to professional career politicians as well?
Well, absolutely. And I mean, you can go even farther than that. For example, when I was in Ireland, I saw the emergence of the direct democracy movement, which is so interesting. A guy by the name of Ben Gilroy announced the formation of this party called Direct Democracy, because the politicians are just completely paying no attention to the electorate in Ireland. They're voting to sell their forests to the EU. So now there's massive deforestation going on. They bailed out the banks despite massive protests against it. And so this direct democracy movement is just a natural outgrowth where basically the people, if they raise 75,000 signatures, can call anything to a binding referendum, completely skirts the bought-out Irish Parliament. Plus, an essential feature of this is for the politicians that you do elect, if they don't do what you want, you can also recall them through a similar process. And this referendum recall was in the original Irish Constitution. And people say, "Oh, well, you're just going to be flooded with referendums and recalls," but really you aren't, because if that type of legislation exists in your nation, then the politicians are aware of it, and so it automatically makes them behave differently. So, for example, the whole time that you had referendum and recall in the initial Irish Constitution, it was never used because the politicians, feared it. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a great, the the direct democracy movement, with modifications, of course, for every individual nation state, is really the way to go. We've way over-centralized the political process in every nation right now, and of course that's been done deliberately, and it's just the natural growth of politicians out of control, out of touch with their constituencies. And they're out of touch because they're in touch with the banks. So we've got to break that link between banks and politicians, between lending and the political process. And I think direct democracy is a good way to go. And you know, they believe that you can do it through the internet, or there are people who question that too. And maybe we could do it through paper ballots. I don't know exactly what the best implementation would be. And once again, that would vary from nation state to nation state. But we have to re-energize the democratic process here in the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, the decision-making process, there is a lot of people out there, and there is also a lot of people who are not interested in this. And I see that as also one of the points of why we've kind of gotten this kind of elite type of decision making, and then kind of a criminal class on top of it. But the fact is that, do you still think that something like a direct democracy would work? Let's say that there was a system set up on the web that every question that was debated or there was going to be a decision, that everyone who was member of that nation, if you will, or citizen, could go in and vote on it. Would that still mean? Would that still work and mean something good if the people who are making the choice and voting don't know about the issues? They are not maybe interested in it. If you see what I'm getting at, there has to be a fundamental interest from the people who want to participate in this. Otherwise, it's like it doesn't matter. Then you can have any system and throw at them. It's still not going to work, right?
Well, we've got to experiment with this. I mean, this is uncharted territory, and we've got to go into it because we've got to do something. And right now, the way this system is going is unsustainable. It's taking us down paths that everybody agrees is completely unsustainable, is going to crack and break one way or another. So we've got to try something else. The current systems were essentially of self-governance were essentially created 200 years ago, and that just doesn't fit the financial sector, the banking sector, and the information transfer sector as it exists today. So we've got to do something different. I think if you provided code that was open source, we transmit trillions of dollars over the internet right now. Certainly, we can write secure code to uniquely identify each voter and authentically count votes. Whether you want to, exactly how you're going to have, what you're going to vote on, that this all needs to be experimented with. For example, Australia is having their federal elections on September 10th, and I've been looking into that because there's a new Australian sovereignty party there, which, of course, is based on monetary reform principles. And Australia is interesting. They mandate, I think they're the only nation that mandates people to vote. No matter, once you turn 18, you are required by law to go and
All right. Okay. Well, I don't know what to think about that, but
Well, I don't either. But it's worthy of experiment. And, I think it's great. I think it's great that the people of Australia had the gall to, step out of the box and try something different. And they also use that type of voting, preferential voting. That's not the exact right name, but where if there are eight candidates running for president, you're instead of just voting for one person, you're asked to go in and vote for the guy you like the best. You put a one besides, and the guy you like second best, and like that, and goes down. If one person doesn't immediately gain a 50% majority, they automatically knock the bottom guy off, and then they recount the balance until they get somebody who does get a 50% majority. And, I think this is very inventive, and I applaud the Australians for doing it that way.
All right. Let me go back to the question of loans again. I kind of wanted to get a little bit more on that in terms of how you see that has been beneficial in the past when it comes to like starting up things, and also what you would think would be a viable option to loans as it's existed, before. And into that, Bill, you can tie in interest and usury if you please as well. But loans have been great in one regard, as I said before, but then very detrimental in another. What system would replace something like that, let's say, that system? with that?
Well, there's nothing wrong with loans. There's nothing wrong with banks. I would not nationalize banking. I want a thriving, healthy, competitive banking industry. The last thing I want to do is see the banking power consolidated, for example, completely nationalized. Then what
Right.
happens with Bill Still, you know, enemy of the people, goes in and wants to get a mortgage loan from the Bank of the United States, and they go, sorry, you're on the list. You're not getting any money from us. Well, then I'm out of luck. You know, and so, some people who actually propose this here in this country, people whose names you would know, who I will not tell you who they are. And I say, well, what's my remedy for such a situation? And they kind of scratched their head and said, well, you could sue them. And I went, oh, that's a great idea, that I would sue an omnipotent Bank of the United States. You know, number one, I don't have the resources. Number two, even if I did, you know, maybe my grandchildren would benefit, but it would certainly not be me. So you need power deconsolidated there. And the only way to do that, in a very effective way, is just have a healthy, thriving, competitive banking industry. But you don't, and you want them to be able to make loans. Loans are okay. It's not the loans that are bad. It's the interest that's bad, the compounding interest problem. The way the Muslims theoretically approach this, and they don't really achieve this in practice, but this is the theory to Muslim banking. It's that, and this is the position of the Catholic Church as well for hundreds of years, and that's it's okay to make loans, but you just can't charge interest. You can charge an initiation fee. Mm-hmm. So a bank would say to loan $100,000, and then they'd calculate in their salaries, their lights, their rental on their building, even their profit margin, but they'd put it all in right up front. And so if you wanted to borrow $100,000, you really wouldn't end up with $100,000. You'd walk out of the bank with, say, $92,000 or $94,000. But then you just have straight payments that would deduct 100% from the principal of the loan without any interest, because the compounding interest is what's killing us, because interest is never created in the original money supply, and so you have to steal the interest money to pay your debts from somebody else so that they don't get to pay their debts. And it is literally a giant Ponzi scheme that's completely unsustainable and is going to end up very badly.
Let me ask you about this, because we talked about nationalizing banks, etc. When Sweden had their bailout back in the 90s, early 90s, through their, I should say manipulated economic crash, but that's another story. But I've said told that one before. But they basically had a situation where a few of the banks that were bailed out were nationalized. And I know that there were people in the US as well that when you guys had your bailout, they wanted to have a similar situation, a similar scenario. I know that there was a division so that one certain bank or another kind of group took care of the uncertain, you know, the more uncertain loans and stuff like that. But does that mean that you would be against that approach to nationalize some of the banks when and if there was a bailout, correct?
No, I don't believe in nationalizing banks. I don't believe in bailouts. I think we need to let the free enterprise system actually work, and that includes in banks. If there's no moral, what's called moral hazard, you're never going to get banks to do the right thing.
Yeah, exactly.
They have to be able to fail. The depositors have to understand that they have to seek out banks that practice securely, that practice good banking practices, and those who don't, they're going to lose their money. And part of that is repealing deposit insurance, because I think that's really one of the big subtle problems with our system right now, is that we insure these deposits, we take away all that risk, and we do is just encourage riskier behavior on the part of the banks.
Well, very good way of explaining that, because again, we're back to personal responsibility. We have to, people have to know where they're placing their money. For example, when this thing in Cyprus happened, when the banks and the government comes in and seizes some of the assets in these accounts, etc., that's the signal when the people should just go, all right, that's it. I'm getting my money out of the bank, you know, even if they can do it or cannot do it at that stage. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's still up to people because people are the ones who are putting their money and their trust ultimately into these banks. So if they're so against them, right, take it out, set something else up. What would you suggest? I mean, credit unions, there are other ways of doing this, right?
Well, I mean, see, but you can look at Cyprus just as another giant experimental laboratory here, because I haven't been to Cyprus, so I don't know exact, but I have a friend who's going there next week, and he's going to find out about this stuff because he is a Cypriot. We're going to see what people are doing. That's the question. What are they doing now after as much as 50% of their deposits have just vanished, been confiscated by the government to pay debts to the European Union?
I mean, it's an unbelievable situation. I mean, and again, it's like people just, if you have to have your money in your mattress, you know, that's a better option at this stage, you know?
Well, that's true. And in fact, there's nothing wrong with dealing in cash. In fact, one of the most famous American economists, Abraham Lincoln's economist, his name was Henry C. Carey, founder of the American School of Economics. There's this wonderful quote of his that I believe I include in Jekyll Island. I think I included in my book No More National Debt as well, where he is raving about the fact that America has almost no lending, that almost all business dealings are done in cash, and that this frees people from the usurious slavery of the banking system. And that's exactly right.
Yeah, it's a good point. So, tell us a little bit more about Jekyll Island, your documentary film about this bill, and basically, obviously, we know about what happened there with the Federal Reserve and everything. But you've done how many documentaries have you done now in total? Three, right? Three big ones.
Yeah, this is the third one. The second one, called The Secret of Oz, won Best Documentary of 2010 at one of the international film festivals here in the United States, and I imagine Jekyll Island is going to do much, much better. I think I look for wins at several film festivals from it, and this subject is just really coming of age. And like I said before, I think that the tipping point has been reached. Although a lot of people don't realize it yet, but a lot of people are now realizing there is a problem, and they're starting to search for answers. And eventually they'll find the answer. And the answer is that banks are controlling the political process, and that's the link that's got to be broken. And that's what we go into in Jekyll Island, trying to understand exactly why Jekyll Island is important, why the bankers met in secrecy on Thanksgiving week of 1910 to try to devise a new system, because the people were demanding changes in the old system, because they realized that it put the banks in control of the booms and busts that they were experiencing so frequently. And so the bankers decided to write their own legislation in secret so that no one would know, and try to insert it as a reform bill. That's why they called it the Federal Reserve System, to give the implication that it was part of the government, and the government was going to, of course, operate in the public interest, when in fact it had no such intention. The Fed is no more federal than Federal Express, and federal courts here in the United States have ruled that as well. So this is not merely a contention, this is a matter of fact. And of course, a private corporation absolutely cannot operate in the public interest. It absolutely must act in the interest of its shareholders, and all the shareholders of the Federal Reserve System are the banks, the large commercial banks in the country. So it absolutely serves only the banks. It does not serve the public interest in the United States, and that's got to be changed. We have to not only change it in this country, but in every country. This function was typically handled by something called the Treasury in all these nation states. And that's basically what you have to do: either put it back in the hands of the Treasury, which still is at arm's length from the legislature, or you have to have a central bank that is owned completely by the government and operates in the public interest. And if I could go into a little bit of this solution, that is, you have to do essentially three things. The first thing you have to do, as I said before, is you have to eliminate the ability of these nation states to borrow, because that's key. If they're borrowing from banks, they're certainly not going to produce effective legislation taking power and money away from the banks. Then secondly, nations have to issue their own debt-free sovereign currency again. I mean, this is the way it was always done in the past, but now somehow these banks have convinced them that no, you need to borrow all your money into existence, which is the case. In the United States here, 97% of our money supply are issued as loans. It's merely credit money issued at interest from banks. We don't. The only thing that the Treasury of the United States issues in the public interest anymore are the coins, the nickels, dimes, and quarters, which is only 3% of the money supply. And this is the figures change slightly from nation to nation, but it's the same for every nation in the world. We have to get out of that. We have to return to the government issuing the quantity of money for the nation for the benefit of all people and issuing it without debt and controlling the quantity effectively. Hmm. The last thing we have to do is forbid the ability of banks to counterfeit money. Right now, as I said before, 97% of money in the U.S. is created as an interest-bearing debt by banks. Who gave them the right to create the money and charge us interest on it?
That's right.
That's called taking back the money power. We have to take back the money power. Banks should only be allowed to, just like you and me, to lend money they actually have. There's plenty of other services banks can do to charge money for that we will happily pay for because we don't want to do those tasks, like ATMs, like keeping track of our checkbooks, like intermediating between people who have money that want to lend it and people who want to borrow it. But they don't have the privilege of just creating money out of nothing, which is a situation across this planet.
Yeah. Wow, it's really unbelievable. How do you see the economy of the United States with the rampant government spending at this stage, how this is going to develop? And is there any hope in sight for the U.S.? How bad is it going to get, do you think? Because, again, there's been talk for a long time now that it's, you know, it's going to crash. It's about to crash, you know. But it seems to kind of, you know, muddle on a little bit here. If you look into your crystal ball, Bill, what's going to happen?
I'm tired of looking into the crystal ball and trying to predict a date because I've been hearing these dates for the last 30 years.
Yeah.
But that's not the point. Bad things are going to happen. You're probably the safest in the U.S. As they say, the U.S. is the cleanest dirty shirt in the laundry. But if you look at the gigantic rise in government debt to GDP, numbers which are very difficult to get reliable figures on because there's so much impetus on so much advantage to these banks and to the Fed to lie about these numbers. But for example, I mistakenly put in the old number for national debt to GDP ratio in a YouTube that I just put up a couple days ago. I think it was 90% or 91%, when in fact the debt to GDP ratio of the United States is 105% right now. Hmm. And according to a recent IMF study, anything over 80% is marginally unsustainable, and 90% is positively unsustainable. And so the U.S. has now crossed over into complete fiscal unsustainability. Now, how this all plays out when all nations are unsustainable simultaneously is something that no one knows how this is going to play out, but it cannot possibly end well.
Yeah.
So people are going to search for answers, and certainly we're going to have a huge downturn in the stock market. I just put up a YouTube on this yesterday. The Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, has given marching orders to the central banks that they have to start contracting. They can't continue with this quantitative easing. They have to start taking money out of the system worldwide. Well, can you imagine the effects on the people of Ireland, for example, or the people of Greece to have even less money than they do right now? Well, that's what's going to happen, and it's going to happen worldwide. It'll be over a period of years, but it's going to happen, and I think it's going to trigger a worldwide depression. And once it does, people are going to see that the solutions that have been offered in the past just are not working. They've been lied to, and that's when we have our opportunity to actually move in and right this struggling economic ship.
I mean, I've said for a long time, Bill, that if something like this does happen, people will just kind of pick up In a natural fashion, I think, and actually starts, you know, and dealing with each other on the basis that they can once it happens, you know, or if it happens, and also at the same time then realize that, you know, it's not with these monetary system that things make it work or function. I mean, it's like we have the amount of goods that we have in place. People have the wealth that they have. Not in, you know, not in paperbacks, of course, but I mean, if they have, you know, precious metals or something like that, they still have that. There is a set, you know, value, if you will, on everything on the planet, and this is not going to change. It's just our imaginative, you know, f monetary, f you know, false monetary system that actually goes up and down in this way, and it's about just overcoming that kind of barrier, if you will, in your thought process to realize that it's like it doesn't stand and fall with whatever monetary system you have on top of it. That's just supposed to represent what already is there in the natural world, right?
Right. Money is just a medium of exchange. And, you know, right now they've co-opted our medium of exchange to take, they're taking a cut off of every dollar that's brought into existence. And we don't need a middleman to create money. I mean, we can exchange our, you can exchange gold and silver coins or cows or whatever,
Yeah.
but that's where money came into existence, is there just needs to be a standardized way that makes trades easier. And whether that comes from the government or whether we the people created ourselves doesn't really make any difference. It will happen, because what's currently going on is not working. And so we'll figure this out. The alternative is nothing but worldwide slavery, and I don't think humanity is about ready to give up on this 1,000-year quest for freedom just yet.
Well, great, you know, great danger means also great opportunity, or you know, when there's a massive change about to take place, there's also a very great opportunity to also then, as you say, reform it into something really, really positive. So with that kind of prospect of something looming, you know, on the horizon, which wouldn't be that good, it actually carries a lot of, you know, potent potential with it, and that's something that I always see as very, very positive. So people shouldn't kind of be too broken down by the fact that it's just their system that might crumble and fall. I mean, I've personally hoped for that to happen for a long time, so that something, a real, more tangible, viable system can come in its place. But what I fear the most, though, Bill, is that, you know, just as you said earlier, you have a number of nations, if not the entire world, that's just like kind of heading in the same direction. And what I fear is that they just will continue as they do, but with a slow reform. But it would basically just mean that every nation in the world is going to get deeper and deeper and deeper into debt, and nothing will change, and we won't break out of that bubble, if you see what I mean. They will just amass more and more control, and maybe reforms of the monetary system will occur, but they will do it on such a level that it doesn't mean that it will actually open it up. And that's what I fear.
Yeah, well, you and I, though, are you know, the epitome of the natural organic response to this overconsolidation of power. And it's not just you and me; it's little yous and me in every nation on every corner of this planet at this point. It's exploding exponentially, and that, combined with the fact of increased internet usage and access, that's going to empower us, not the bad guys. The bad guys are empowered by making resources scarce. That's why gold money is bad, because it's a scarce money supply. That's why TV networks are bad, because it consolidates power and makes access to the media scarce. And all those trends are going in our way, are going away from consolidated systems into deconsolidated systems. And that's only going to benefit us. You know, we're going to go through a rough time making this change, because, you know, they've been after this consolidation of power thing. Basically, I put the marker down at 1694 with the beginning of the Bank of England, the debt money system. So they've been after this for a little over 300 years. So we're not going to wipe it out in a single year. But I definitely see that our forces are improving, and their forces are getting more and more black marks besides their name. And eventually, we're going to come to a tipping point, and we're going to make some changes.
Let me tie back around again here. Let's go back to Greece for a little bit, Bill, before we begin to round things up for this time. How do you see that they would manage to get themselves out of the European Union at this stage, with things being as they are right now? What would it entail, do you think, to just try to get the nation out?
Well, number one, you have to energize the voting electorate of Greece, that this is what we need to do. We need to tell our politicians that we want out of the EU. The EU is bad. Yes, it's like promising that Big Daddy's going to take care of your debts, but Big Daddy is not really taking care of their debts. It's just adding on to their debts and increasing their misery through austerity. So I don't think that's going to be that difficult to sell to the Greek population. And once that tipping point occurs, and the politicians, you start, electing some really nasty-looking radical political parties are even rising up in Greece because the controlled parties are not providing the solution. So, once again, there's a natural organic process here, and I just want to push it along and, concentrate efforts into what the real solution is, which has got to be the monetary system. And number one step is to get people out of the EU so that they can devise their own monetary system, whatever it turns out to be. But as long as the people are doing it and the people are in control, it's going to be 1,000 times better than the system they have right now. So that's how you get out of it in Greece. It's all of this is a political process. That's why I want people to get in there and fight to take their governments back, because without the political process, we have absolutely no hope.
All right, very good. We're going to round things up here in a little bit. Anything else you want to add to our discussion? Anything else in terms of where you're going or heading or speaking or anything like that, so people know where they can pick up if you're in their area?
Well, really, the primary way that I communicate at this point is I'm really fascinated with YouTube. I think it's the most powerful political force on the planet. So my YouTube channel is, and I'm supposed to know this off the top of my head, Be Still and the number 3. And I'm trying to produce a new YouTube every couple days on, there's so many things that are important. The Australian thing, the escape of Hungary from the debt money system and from the IMF. There's so many things going on. I just did one on Iceland and them telling the EU to go away. So Be Still 3 is my YouTube channel, and that's really the way I communicate. And that's all.
BillStill.com. We're going to have that up, and then also check out Jekyll Island dash the movie.com. That's where you can find more about the truth behind the Federal Reserve, and then YouTube.com/BeStill3. And we're going to have all these links up. Thank you so much, Bill, for joining us. I hope you have a great time over in Greece and when you travel over there, and good luck with the production of the videos and everything else.
Thank you very much.
Some of our upcoming guests include Anna Maria and Brian Clement on Toxic Clothing. That's on Radio 314. Then on Red Ice Radio, we have Suzanne Venker on The War on Men. Later, Joseph Atville and Ryan Gilmore. We also have another big roundtable on the past and our future. We also have Charles Eisenstein, Anthony Peake, and Jared Andringa, to name a few. My thanks to Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and John. Also, a warm and a special thanks to all you fantastic members out there. Keep searching, keep questioning. And we will talk to you in just a few days. Be well, take care.